If you're ready to confront your destiny, if this is the moment that you've been praying for, tune in and listen to your cosmic cheerleader, Commander Lady Athena, for cosmic pep talks for closet Christ. The show is the voice of the Astar Command. The call is for you to step forward into your greatness. Be listening on Wednesday. We have an appointment with destiny.
Greetings and the love of the One Beloved. I'm Commander Lady Athena, and you're listening to the voice of the Astar Command. This evening our topic is practicing being enlightened, moment by moment. I want to start out with a funny story. This is one that my good friend Dan Millman tells. And it's about a man, it's a true story, a man named Ron Kaufman. And the only thing this man liked to do on the whole planet was play frisbees. He liked to see those plastic discs glide through the air. But the problem was, Ron was 35 years old, and his parents suggested that he get a life, grow up and find a real job. So in addition to tossing frisbees, Ron had a larger vision of promoting world peace. So one day it occurred to him to combine his two passions, and he contacted representatives of the WHAMO company and asked if they would sponsor him to fly to the then Soviet Union and provide him with 500 frisbees imprinted with the words World Peace in English and in Russian. Well, they agreed. And Ron became, get this, a frisbee goodwill ambassador, teaching people throughout Russia to play the game and talk about peace. Ultimately, Ron formed a company that led goodwill frisbee tours to Russia, where he also met his wife. Doing what he loves, serving other people, Ron thrived, along with his business. The moral is simple. If you can't find a career that satisfies you, then invent your own. I think that's a great story, because so often we starseed feel like, you know, fifth wheels. We're just not quite with the program here on the earth. We just are calibrated to a whole different world, a world without money, a world that accommodates our unique expression as embodiments of divinity. So what we're learning is that we set our own limits, we set our own boundaries, and we hobble ourselves, and it's really not necessary to do that. We actually, in fact, can enable the universe to coalesce around us. So tonight we're going to look at how we can facilitate that coalescing of our essence within the universe so that we can find that place where we really flourish, not just survive, but flourish and blossom and really impart our unique gift to the earth. Everything in life, actually, is learned through observation, repetition, practice, and doing. Every life skill, every habit, every ability is acquired in just the same manner, through observation, repetition, practice, and doing. You can see this throughout nature. Every single species of animal learns in exactly the same manner. Monkeys learn how to be monkeys through observing and imitating behavior of other monkeys. And children observe the lifestyle and behavior of their parents and begin at a very early age to imitate and act out what they see around them. In fact, the young of every species, including the human, are completely innocent. They're like a tabula rasa with no trace of preconditioning, no judgment, no discernment either for that matter. Because to a child, you know, everything is fascinating and to be examined and played with. I was reminded of a story when I was, maybe 2 years old. My mother said that I came running up to her from the backyard, and clutching in my fist, I had this poisonous snake. And I said, look, Mommy, pretty baby, pretty baby. You know, I had no concept that I was holding a poisonous snake. To me, it was just a pretty baby. So some of you, I think, know that I spent my teen years growing up in the circus. Now, in the circus, young children in the circus, the children of performers, they play act at being circus performers. And I used to get such a kick out of watching them because, you know, I was a young kid myself. And so I'd often babysit the younger toddlers. And they would announce their act with a great flourish, and they'd say something like, attention, ladies and gentlemen, we now present the great Tetrazzinis. And I would get such a kick out of the names they would make up. You know, they would always be some sort of a name like Tetrazzini or Wazzini or whatever. And they would start their act. And maybe it would be a board between two chairs, or maybe they'd be juggling balls or whatever. But they would perform their little stunts, and then they'd bow and copy as best they could the various acts that they'd seen. And nothing, of course, seems impossible. The most fearful stunts seem quite normal to a child that grows up in that kind of environment. I also noticed that amongst the child performers, that up until about the age of six, children were totally without fear, and they could be taught to do the most daring stunts. And bear in mind, this was years before safety nets and other safety precautions became the law. So, you know, if we want to do anything in our life, the secret, the real secret to manifestation is to envision yourself doing it, to just move your whole headspace into being and doing and having and living in that. You get so caught up in the inner visualization of that state of being that it begins to consume you. I think probably, well, they say that anything you can envision yourself doing, you actually, in fact, can do. But if you begin to study the lives of people who have achieved outrageous and bodacious things, without exception, they all say that they kept seeing themselves in their mind's eye. In fact, some people have visions from the time they're a child. They have visions in which they see themselves in the future doing a particular thing. And Benny Hinn, for example, the great evangelist and healer, he was telling, he was a little boy, he had such a stutter that he barely could say two words. In fact, it took him so long to get the two words out that people would just kind of, you know, trounce all over him and discount him entirely. And he was so shy that he would hide under the bed when anyone would come to visit. Despite that, he started having a series of visions where he saw himself in a white suit, standing and preaching the gospel before millions of people. And he kept having that vision and having that vision, even though everyone in his family said, oh, poor little Benny, he's never, you know, going to amount to anything at all. And they really discouraged him. But lo and behold, the day that he stood up to give his first testimony, not even a sermon, but testimony, the Holy Spirit healed his stutter, and he went on to be a greatly anointed minister and man of God and evangelist. So, likewise, many times the things that you're going to be doing in your future, especially you young star-seeded emissaries that are coming in that are calibrated and set for the golden age, which hasn't quite landed on Earth yet. It's in the process of being externalized through us. You're starting to have visions. You're starting to be shown what you're going to be doing. And it might not even make sense because it might have to do with intergalactic travel and colonization of nearby planets. It may have to do with healing by cellular cloning, not cloning entities, but cloning organs, perhaps through microscopic laser insertions into the organ itself within the person without invasive surgery. You might be having all sorts of inventions that you see yourself implementing and facilitating into the world, and there's not even the technology to produce these things yet on the planet. So pay attention to your visions. Pay attention to your dreams. Nothing, literally nothing, is impossible to the embodied sons and daughters of God that we are. Nothing is impossible. So begin to allow all the conditioning of the third dimension, which has confined and defined and separated and limited, let's just jettison all of that and begin to realize that we are absolutely encoded for a golden age. We are encoded to do wondrous, marvelous things that go beyond anything that has ever been thought, taught, imagined, done ever before on this planet. New slate, completely new paradigm, and it can be exactly as we dream in our most sacred heart space. It is to be that way. It can be that way. So, again, back to envisioning yourself, how you would be in your wildest, most joyful, freeing, expansive, embodied self. What would that be like? Let's just take a deep breath. And we ask at this time for clearing for everyone listening to this show. We ask at this time that whatever can possibly be adjusted and set in the proper positioning in terms of the nervous system, the chakras, the consciousness, the awareness, the willingness and the openness to receive the next step, if that could be quickened and activated now. We ask this in the name of the Most High and all those who facilitate the divine plan throughout the cosmos that love and nurture and oversee and work with the men and women of this planet, the volunteer spirits onto this planet, and everyone that has come to be part of the building team for this beautiful golden age that we are in the process of transitioning into. And we ask that dreams and visions and knowings be imparted, that the ones listening may become super aware and sensitized to the joyous beckoning of their magnificent futures, the things that have been encoded and set for them to manifest and to express, to invent, and to creatively share and impart to this world. And we ask, Father, that they be strengthened in their enthusiasm, in their hope, in their strength, in their sustainability, that they can be inspired to envision the best, that they can close their ears to the naysayers and the derogatory words of those who would dissuade them, that they can listen clearly to the voice of the guiding spirit within them that will enable them to fulfill their highest potential. And just take another deep breath. And allow that activation, that clearing, and that impartation to settle over you like a mantle of golden sunlight. Allow it to anoint every particle of your being with luminosity and the great largesse and generosity of spirit, the great abundance, the great overflowing all-sufficiency of the all that is, that will enable you to step forward with greater alacrity, greater purpose, greater awareness, greater centeredness, greater integration of all levels of your being. And just place into that equation your heart's desire now. Just place it forward into the light. And we ask that that be blessed, and that it may manifest through each person according to their highest rate and highest good. Baruch Hashem Adonai. Blessed is the name of the Lord. Amen. So, what do you do all day long, every day, that you are practicing? Because what you do all day, every day, is what you're practicing. And what you keep doing, you keep strengthening. And what you keep practicing and strengthening, you keep refining and perfecting. And bear in mind, enlightenment is endless. It's not a goal to be attained and then that's it. No, it's a constantly unfolding quantum expansion of knowingness and beingness and manifestation and creative expression and extension. So we're always going to be refining, fine-tuning, and perfecting. Gosh, I'm learning so much. Playing my harp. Every day I have to tune the harp several times a day and keep practicing and practicing and practicing over and over and over. And those days when I get a little discouraged, I think, oh, wow, this is, you know, it's hard to keep practicing the beginning little steps over and over and over. But I encourage myself by saying, you know, all I have to do is keep practicing. That's all I have to do. I will perfect. I will accomplish. And the other day I noticed, wow, all of a sudden my fingers can find those strings without looking and placing each one separately. Wow, and I was so excited because all of a sudden my nervous system and in my kinesthetic awareness of the harp, I was beginning to place my fingers naturally without looking and without thinking about it. And I was excited because that was a growth curve for me, a learning curve. And likewise, you'll notice that the little things that you do that you really have to think about, that, well, you know, like the first time you learn to ride a bicycle. Remember how, you know, your wheel wobbled and you kept looking at the trees and whatever you looked at, you'd steer into it and fall off? But after a while, you didn't even think about it. And you wondered why it was so hard in the beginning, because after you learned how to ride the bike, you don't think about it. You just hop on that sucker and you're off and you're going. Same thing with driving a car. You got to think about every little thing when you first start. And after a while, you're talking, carrying on a conversation, listening to music. You're not even thinking about driving. And your body knows how to do that. So a big part of it is training the brain, neurological system, muscular, volitional coordination until it becomes an ingrained tendency, becomes a habit. And like anything else, mastery, self-governance, self-conscious direction becomes a habit as you practice it. So our challenge always when it comes to the spiritual life, when it comes to expanding awareness, is maintaining a conscious practice of self-direction and awareness, minute by minute, act by act, day by day, in the little things that you do. Last show I mentioned how important it is to do the little things. You know, the little things that keep a life in order, that establish stability, that establish continuity and balance and flow, and all of the things that go for having your ducks in order, you know, having all those things lined up. And the simplest thing, you know, keeping your room or your environment clean and making your bed and making sure that the dishes are washed in the sink, little silly things like that are all part of that process. In fact, the more you go into the spiritual life, the more you realize this is that and that is this, and they're all the same. Spirit is matter, matter is spirit, they're one and the same. The physical life in the human dimension is just the same as the divine life in the so-called invisible dimension. They're no different. As above, so below. As within, so without. And I was thinking the other day, I thought, gosh, you know, my life has become so monotoned that I can't tell whether I'm praying or not, because it's become such a state of ongoing communion. I sometimes can't tell if my eyes are open or closed, because sometimes I see the same dimensions whether my eyes are open or closed. The other night my housemate went in and he said, oh, well, I guess you see in the dark, because I was reading a book and it was dark. But because I have so much light in my head, I didn't realize that the sun had gone down and there was actually dark in the room. So there again, I can't tell sometimes if it's day or night or if it's light or it's dark. Things have become more and more sameness for me. And what I wanted to say is that don't misinterpret that when it happens to you. as boredom, or that you're not having spiritual experiences, or that you're somehow lost your groove or whatever, or that you're in a dry period. But what if you've moved more into the unified whole, which doesn't have those strong lines of demarcation between spiritual, quote, quote, and, quote, quote, material? What if they just sort of homogenized? I was talking to someone the other day, and the thing that was expressed was, well, I don't have any experiences of Jesus anymore. You know, what am I, chopped liver? You know, this one has visions, and that one hears his voice, and that one sees him, and you know, I'm so crazy about Jesus. What's wrong with this? Why don't I see him? Why don't I have dreams of him? And the answer was, well, because perhaps you've merged your consciousness with him. So he's no longer an outside reference point. He's become merged into an inner state of being. So I'm suggesting that the more we practice the enlightening process, the more we're going to become homogenized and wholized, in the sense that we don't have these strong ups and downs, these strong lines of demarcation between this and that, in terms of the polarities that we've used to define ourselves in the lower dimensions. I'm suggesting that we just sort of dance with whatever is present and don't make ourselves at fault because it's different than it was a year ago or 10 years ago or whatever. I hope it's different than it was 10 years ago or a year ago or you know, nothing much has gone on. So just take a look at that and see if that might be the case with you. So what we do all the time is what we're really going to be good at. So what are you observing and emulating every day? They had on Dr. Phil this young woman who was acting precociously for her age, and it was disturbing her parents. But when they found out that the only thing the girl watched or had any access to whatsoever in terms of entertainment was watching these teenage shows and MTV. So naturally she was trying to imitate a behavior that was very sexual and very precocious for her age, being, I think she was 13, 14 years old. And of course she was going to be modeling herself after what she was constantly exposed to. She was never exposed to anything else. What else is she going to emulate? So what we're exposed to all the time through all the intake gates, the eye gates and ear gates and the sensory gates that we have in every cell of our being is constantly taking in data and beginning to come into an agreement, a vibrational affinity with whatever it is we hang out with a great deal. So that's why, again, it's important that if you want to be enlightened, that you hang out with the most enlightened, aware, and spiritually expansive individuals as you possibly can. And if you're not blessed with such satsang, you can at least read books of such people. You can do web searches for such web groups and people. And you can also listen to the music that is part of that energetic field, whether it's devotional chanting, you know, Sanskrit chants, or whatever it is that your thing is, you can match it with an appropriate diet that begins to feed that. Today I was watching something marvelous. I was watching the Kala Chakra, a Tibetan Buddhist initiation that was presided over by the Dalai Lama in Bodh Gaya in India. And thousands and thousands of people from all over India and Asia had gone to watch this yantra, this sand yantra, which is called the Kala Chakra, this intricate design being made over a period of 10 days. And all of the impartation and the teachings and everything that went on with it. Well, it was interesting to me because I noticed in terms of emulation, people were prostrating and bowing. You know, they would do 100,000 prostrations where they would fall forward on their, their whole body lays down on the ground and then they get up, and then down, and up, and down. And I got a kick out of watching the little tiny kids, you know, little toddlers. They were watching the behavior of the monks, and they were trying to emulate it. Again, you learn by observing and watching and practicing and imitating. And here are these little babies trying to do that. And they had one man who had prostrated every few steps from the Amdo region, which is in the high Tibetan, actually it's in China now, the high Tibetan mountains, all the way down to Bodh Gaya, which is close to Varanasi or Benares in India, which incidentally I was born there in my last lifetime. And this man had prostrated every few feet. I can't even imagine how a human being could do that. And it had taken him 3.5 years to arrive at this Kala Chakra initiation in Bodh Gaya. And he didn't look any the worse there. I mean, he had a very cheerful face, and he was calm and composed and quite slender, but otherwise quite intact. And this is a process that not everyone comes from the Amdo region, but a lot of people came to this Kala Chakra initiation through prostrating. In fact, they had the walk paths, and then they had the path in the center for people that are going to go every few steps and prostrate. And there were men and women doing that from wherever their village was or wherever the distance that they were coming from. And it was just a beautiful study. And the fervor, the dedication, and the focus that people have in that particular Buddhist practice. And if you have not had the blessing of traveling as I have, and spending time in the Himalayas, and visiting the Buddhist monasteries and the Hindu gurus and ashrams as I have, you can rent these wonderful DVDs. I got mine from Netflix. And they have this great, you know, library of wonderful spiritual and faith and inspirational DVDs. And I watched another one on the Chartreuse Monastery. It's called The Great Silence, of this group of monks. And their whole day is spent in silence and contemplation. And the only time you hear any words uttered really is when they are saying their prayers, you know, their communal chanting and their communal songs. Otherwise, they're in the contemplative state all the time. And the movie was 2.5 hours, and it just brought you into this steady, quiet space where you, for me, it's like a living. You know, I have a mini life in that because I move my consciousness right into it and live it. And it cools our Western jets down because we just get too revved up with all the stuff that goes on in our world. And it's, you know, it's not necessary because most people, it seems like today, are all worked up about financial matters and, you know, how to survive and how to pay this and how to pay that. And these cultures that I was watching and these lifestyles and my lifestyle in the circus had virtually nothing to do with money. You know, we didn't really think about that. It's like it goes without saying, if you put forth quality service, or in the case of a circus performer, if you do your act well, you're going to have enough to get to the next town. And that's kind of the way you think. You think in terms of getting to the next town, feeding your animals, you know, feeding your family. But, you know, you don't stress about survival and money. You kind of take that as a given if you do your duty, if you do what you love to do. And I want to reinforce that thinking with us, because if you buy into money as your source of support, you're going to be sorely disappointed and have yourself a strong lesson to learn. Because money is not what sustains you. What sustains you is your connection to the universe, your connection to Source, your connection to God. That's what sustains you. That's what feeds you, enlivens you, empowers you, and inspires you to do the things that you're meant to do. And when you lack that, it's because you're not meant to do it. So I think humanity's in for a big, big lesson in terms of learning what their support is and what really sustains them. And moreover, these cultures in Asia and India and Mexico and the Latin American countries, they're largely based not on money, but on community and family. And they have found that those countries are actually happier per capita than the westernized money and technology-based societies. Because we lose, it seems like the more money we have, the more we isolate and separate and lose connection. It separates rather than joins. And you notice whenever there's a tragedy or a disaster, it causes people to come together. They come together to help one another. And so, you know, part of the lesson of these earth changes is to get us from our isolation chambers and get us out involved with other people. Get us into more of a communal type of approach to life. Because I know that together we will join to discover new ways to collaborate and create community and solutions, not only for our mutual surviving, but for our mutual flourishing. And I know that's really the next step for us on our planet. And God knows, you know, if money were, you know, so secure, then why could it vanish in just the tumble of the stock market, or, you know, somebody stealing it or embezzling it or whatever? I mean, it's so easily lost. How could that possibly be anything we could place our faith in? So back to visualizing and envisioning. I remember when I was 10 years old, I fell in love with the circus. I was completely gaga over the circus. Well, I loved two things. I loved dancing, and I loved horses. So I thought, what could be better than to be a dancer on a horse, you know, be a circus performer? So night and day, I thought of nothing else but the circus. I watched it on television, and I listened to circus music. And in my mind's eye, I visualized all the time. I saw myself performing. I saw myself on the beautiful white horses. Anything I could possibly hang from my knees or stand on top or leap from, I was always, you know, practicing my art. I would stand on my poor horse until she would just be exhausted. I'd make her gallop, and then I'd stand up on her, and of course I'd fall off every few gallops. And she would stop and come back and look at me and nuzzle me, and I'm sure I just worried her to no end. But nevertheless, I was determined to join the circus, which really seemed impossible given my circumstances at that point in my life. But as faith and fate would have it, we moved to Buckeye Lake, Ohio, which was a summer resort on a lake that had an amusement park. And every summer there was a free act that would come and perform. And the free act that I got involved with was the Poodles Hannaford bareback riding family, English bareback riding family. And needless to say, I lived, you know, under the horse tent of this riding family until finally, when one of the girls left the act, they wired my mother and asked if I could join the act because they felt that I would be a very good bareback rider. They had no idea. I was just, you know, 13 years old. But my mother, God bless her, she was so tired of hearing about the circus that she thought, well, you know, a good summer in the circus for this little spoiled girl is going to cure her real good. So she packed me up, and we drove to Richmond, Virginia, where the circus was at that time. And I joined. And at first they weren't going to take me when they found out I was so young because they didn't want the responsibility. And then my mom assured them that it was fine with her, and, you know, she trusted them and all of that. So, and, you know, I'd known these people for now, you know, almost 3 years. So it wasn't like they were strangers. And they had a daughter and two other young teenagers. So, you know, it wasn't too bad. So anyway, I joined the Poodles Hannaford family. I got an allowance of $7.50 a week, and that would seem like a fortune to me at that time. And I I was worked like I had never worked in my life. Oh my gosh, I had to do everything, you know, all the washing and all the ironing and everything. And it wasn't like we had a laundromat. I used to do the washing in one of those big galvanized steel wash tubs. You probably have never even seen one. Well, they water horses in them sometimes, but that's where I did all of the washing. Not just my washing, but the washing for the costumes and everything. And on a wash, you know, one of those scrub board things, old-fashioned things, in cold water. And then I'd have to iron them and starch them and, you know, fix all of the riding shoes that we wore. I had to polish them. And basically, I did all the work, all the slave labor. And in exchange, I was taught the art of Rosenback riding. And the Rosenback, they call a horse, a bareback rider, a Rosenback rider, because they powder resin and put it on the horse's back. They dust the backs of the horses so that your feet don't slide when you're standing up on them. And eventually, when you quit falling off, you learn to stand up. But it was hard to know whether I spent more time on top of the horse or under the horse or between the horses, but eventually I did learn. And, you know, it's one of those things that it was very good training for the spiritual life, because there's just no place in the circus for slackers or whiners. You just, whatever you have to do, the show must go on. And you're accounted to be part of that troupe. If you've hurt yourself, man, you just tape that whatever it is up. You put the liniment on it, and you just get back there and work again. So I was not allowed to rest for a second. I either had to be doing chores or I had to be doing push-ups or chin-ups over and over and over, because you don't just do one thing in the circus. You have a lot of different acts that you have to do. So you have to have a very strong body. So this was all good. It was kind of like yoga because you really were taught to train yourself, to discipline yourself, and to work hard and to work as part of a team. You know, the circus is all about teamwork and camaraderie and one for all and all for one. And it was wonderful training. And then, of course, I had my school lessons that had to be done, and I had to be self-motivated to do that, because if I didn't get good grades, and I did all my high school by correspondence, if I didn't have good grades, my mom would yank me home in a heartbeat. So that was my thing that I had to discipline myself to do. And there wasn't any other child that was taking, you know, correspondence school. So I had to teach myself and be motivated to do that. And then in the evening, we didn't watch TV. We didn't have one for a long time. But we would do the bugle beads, those glass beads, or the spangles, those shiny little round discs on costumes. We would spangle the costumes for hours, you know, and put those little beads on one by one, which I hate sewing. Oh, man, that was hard. But it was a good place for a rambunctious teenager, I must say. And then at 15, I was invited to join the Alberto Zoppé troupe from Italy. And they barely spoke English, so, of course, I became fluent at speaking Italian really quick. And here my skills included aerial training by the great Carl Wallenda of High Wire fame. And I was trained to do the Iron Jaw slide for life. In fact, I only know one other person that's actually done that, so I might have been one of the last ones to do that, for all I know. And I was very frightened because there was no safety equipment. And here you're hanging by your teeth, and you have to slide down a 45-degree wire several hundred feet really fast, and nothing to hold on to. And then about 10 feet before you come to the end of the wire, they blow a whistle, you reach up, and there's a braking device that you have to apply very slowly so you don't jerk your teeth out of your mouth and break your neck. And anyway, the first time I did it, I was in Mexico City, and man, I was so scared. But I wasn't going to let anybody know I was scared, right? So I'm up there about 100 feet in the air, and you know, lower my body down and start to hang by my teeth, which took, by the way, a long time to learn to hang by my teeth because it's so terribly painful on the neck. And then, just to show I was a brave girl, I gave myself a little extra swing So I went down really fast. I went down so fast that I couldn't hear them when they blew the whistle. And they made a flying tackle for my body, you know, the people at the bottom of the wire. And thank God didn't break my neck. Thank God my teeth stayed in my head. And I fainted dead away. So it was so scary. And again, it's good training because you learn to do it scared. You learn not to allow fear or pain or sickness or anything to stop you from doing what you need to do. And you play it over and over and over in your mind, and you keep thinking it and visualizing it until one day you are a wonderful whatever it is you're doing. And in my case, I became a very, very beautiful aerial performer. And not a bad bareback rider either. But discipline, oh my gosh. I remember when I, at 19, I left the circus to go home to my dad and his family and go to the university. And, wow, I thought, they've got a hot bathtub. I hadn't seen a bathtub for years. I mean, you learn how to take a bath, shampoo your hair, and do your wash with two buckets of water in a cold tent where the flaps are blowing up and the wind is coming through, and no hot water, no warm fuzzies at all, just like really hard stuff. So I remember when I got in that bathtub and the bubbles and, you know, and having a gesture drawers all to myself and having a really comfortable bed. Wow, it's like heaven. I couldn't believe it. And to think people live like that all the time and they have these big houses and they have lots of beautiful clothes. I could have like two pairs of jeans and one dress-up dress and one pair of everyday shoes and one pair of dress shoes. That was it. That was all I had. And, I mean, you know, you just have very little. And you learn to be very, very careful with what you've got because you're sharing space with a lot of people. And you just have to learn to really to live conscious of other people and your effects on other people. So again, it's very, very, very good training. So anyway, I wanted to share that with you because it, again, proved that my constant visualization, constant seeing myself doing that, manifested very rapidly in my finding a way or the universe facilitating my way of joining the circus. And again, it kind of came to me because I was invited by both those acts to join them. It wasn't like something that I had to do. I just visualized and everything else came and fell into place. So bear that in mind, that see yourself actually having whatever it is that you desire to manifest. Don't say, one day I want to, or I want to, or I desire to. No, it's thank you, God, for, well, my life as a circus performer. Thank you for my wonderful, abundant, and beautifully expressive ministry. Thank you, Lord, that I have this beautiful home and this beautiful car and this beautiful life. Thank you that I have this wonderful person in my life that absolutely adores me and would rather be with me than anyone in the world. Thank you so much. And begin to luxuriate in that feeling of having it. Begin to wear it. Begin so much to live in that state that you just can't even imagine that it's not real. You know, I thought I had won several million dollars in an inheritance a few years back. And I remember how I felt and how carefully I planned for the husbanding. Well, forget that word. I can't think of what to say. The stewardship, that's what I want to say. I kept thinking of what I had to do to be a wise steward of that money, you know, to get in the financial advisor and set up the trust funds and all of the things that would go into managing that amount of money. And then I went out and I sat behind a car, the wheel of a car, that I intended to buy. And I went and I checked out an apartment, really nice apartment with a swimming pool and everything that I wanted that I was going to move into. And they were not extravagant because, you know, I don't have extravagant tastes, really. So it wasn't like crazy, you know. It was a nice car, but it wasn't like, you know, real expensive. And it was a nice apartment, but the reason I liked it was because it was close to my church. And I began to live as if there was no financial boundaries in my life whatsoever. As if everything that I wanted to do was not only possible, I was setting plans to do it. And after about 2-3 months, it became obvious that I was not going to get the inheritance. But by that time, it had become such a habit for me to live as if I was extremely wealthy that feeling of having that wealth has lasted with me all these many years later. And so I know that the fact that I have a very serene life in which I live a very wealthy life, even though I'm not wealthy, I have a wealthy feeling within me. I have a feeling of having. I have a feeling of support. I have a feeling of well-being in terms of finances. And I know it's because not only do I have incredible trust in the universe to support me because I am doing my God-given dharma. I am doing the things that I love to do. I am contributing. And I know that's always rewarded. But, and I'm also tithing. I'm also living in integrity, which is, again, part of that. But I also have the mental equivalent of what it feels like to have great wealth. So begin, if this is important to you, begin to really meditate, fantasize, daydream, contemplate, mock up, and envision the havingness of whatever it is that your little sweethearts desire, and begin to see how it manifests. And be quite specific about the feeling quality, the emotional quality of the havingness of whatever it is. And that's one thing I encourage you to do, because I know it's the very quintessential secret of beginning to manifest the enlightened groundedness that we all want to manifest. We know that this is our time to move into enlightenment, and we are enlightened already in the eternal now. So living as an enlightened being is simply bringing your human consciousness to the remembrance of what you already are as your natural God-given state. It's just bringing yourself into the eternal now from the becomingness to the beingness of it, the havingness of it, and the manifestation of it. And I think we all have a pretty good mental image of what it is to be enlightened. An enlightened person is not got a lot of stress and worry and concern about things in life. They're relaxed. They're living a stress-free, flowing, participatory, joyful, loving, and positive expression. They're contributing to life. They're taking themselves easy. They're not, seeing everything against them. They're seeing the things in the universe cooperating to flow them into their highest good. They have a really positive approach towards life. And they know that, like practicing anything, they keep sowing the seeds that they wish to see as their future harvest, secure in the fact that if they put good seed in the ground, they're going to reap good harvest. So begin to think of your life as a everyday sowing the seeds for the harvest that you would have be yours, and for the manifesting of that which you know you've come to be and do. We all have that knowing within us of what we're impressed and designed to fulfill and to manifest. It's like, it's there. It's always there. And give yourself permission to come into the awareness of that. And then begin to act from it. Just enact your enlightenment as if you were an actor in a play, if you wish. Act as if, to begin with, until you begin to train your neurological system, your brain responses, your kinesthetic awareness, until you don't even have to think about it. It just becomes your natural state of being. That's what I learned in the circus, too, is that you practice until your body takes over and knows exactly what to do. It knows the timing and the rhythm and the sensitivity, and everything just flows. You become the act. Instead of doing an act, you become the act itself. So you become the light, the enlightened state of approaching your life. And it's easier to do that than actually to talk about it. But sometimes we don't think about it as a day-to-day, moment-to-moment approach to life. And be the enlightened one as you do your dishes. Do the zen of dishes. Do the zen of childcare. Do the zen of fixing your car. Do the zen of driving on the freeway. Do the zen of making your bed. Do the zen of whatever it is you do in your life. Be the zen. Be the zone. Get in the zone of that. Flow with it. Do the aikido of it. Let it become that martial art that becomes the way of the master in your life and through your life and through everything that you do. And as you practice that, you'll find it becomes easier and easier until pretty soon you're just integrated, centered, whole, free, ascended, and walking in radiant mastery. And you don't even remember how you got there. It was just one conscious choice after another to be the excellence that you strive for, to be the enlightened one that you always knew you were, and to just let that have permission to completely flow through you. We're all enlightened. We're all masters. The soul of everyone is a master. And so it's just a matter of bringing that agreement through to your conscious self, to your basic selves, to every level of your being, so you have all your team on deck with you and cooperating with you. I think you'll love it. It's a wonderful way to live a life, an ordinary life, in an extraordinary way. And you'll find that all great masters, without exception, have made the ordinary moments into an extraordinary life of luminosity and self-giving and wisdom and compassion. And that's what we're all designed to be and do. So good luck in your practicing. We're all practicing something, so we might as well practice being enlightened moment by moment, and enjoy enacting the role of an enlightened ascended being until it just simply is what we've always been. So let's close our shows chanting, let's do the sacred name of God, Hu. Take a deep breath. Hu. God willing, I'll be with you next week. Adonai.